Lecture 5.
Hello. In our last lecture, we talked about counts. We talked about how if you work as a patent examiner in the U.S. Patent Office, you think of little else. And that for those of us who are outside of the patent office, either because we work in a patent firm representing inventors, or because we work in the patent department of a corporation that has a patent department or something, that it's to our advantage to pay attention to counts, to know what they are. Now I will turn briefly to a more detailed point relating to the filing receipts that I mentioned earlier. What should you do when you get a filing receipt? Well, what you should do is look over the filing receipt really carefully. You need to try to figure out if anything is wrong on that filing receipt. Now, there are some simple things you could look for. Did they misspell the name of an inventor? Did they get the title wrong? You thought you filed 22 pages. Do they say you only filed 21 pages? You thought you had 7 sheets of drawings. Do they say that you only have 6? I mentioned earlier the possibility that one of the reasons you might be filing a U.S. patent application is that at a previous time, there had been a patent application filed in a foreign country. And I mentioned the possibility that you might use what's called the Paris Convention to take advantage of this opportunity to file in the United States under circumstances where the U.S. application will be treated as if it had been filed on the day that the previous application was filed in the foreign country. Well, this is supposed to be mentioned on the filing receipt. If you filed in the U.S., why? Because something was filed in Japan 11 months ago, and you'd like to have the U.S. application get the benefit of the filing date of that previous Japanese application from 11 months ago, that had better be mentioned on the filing receipt. And if you don't see it there, then you need to try to figure out what went wrong. You need to figure out where was there some misunderstanding or confusion. I also mentioned in a previous lecture that sometimes when you file a patent application in the U.S. Patent Office, it's because there was a previous filing of what is called a provisional patent application in the U.S. Patent Office. And although we haven't really talked about what a provisional patent application is or why you would file it, what's important for what I'm talking about right now is that if you filed your application with the goal that it would relate back to the previous provisional application, that fact had better be mentioned on the filing receipt. And if it's not mentioned, you need to figure out what went wrong. You need to figure out where the misunderstanding was, where the difficulty was. There is also something mentioned on every filing receipt, which is whether you do or do not have a foreign filing license, or FFL. U.S. law says that if you invented something in the United States, you had best not file it in a foreign country before you file it in the United States. When I say best not, I'm sort of being colloquial. In fact, if you file outside of the U.S. before you file in the U.S., you can be in a lot of trouble. If it turns out that the invention was of national security importance, it related to nuclear weapons or cryptography or any of a number of other things that are thought to be important for purposes of national security of the United States, and if it turns out you exported that invention without first filing in the U.S. Patent Office and without getting a foreign filing license, you might be in big trouble, indeed possibly even criminal trouble. Even if your invention has no national security importance, even if your invention is merely a better mousetrap, it catches mice. If you file outside of the U.S. before you file in the U.S., and if you didn't have a so-called foreign filing license granted by the U.S. Patent Office, then the act of having filed outside the U.S. without the benefit of a foreign filing license will mean that you have forever given up any chance of getting U.S. patent coverage. What this means is that if you have an invention that was made in the United States, you ought to be thinking about this foreign filing license question. In broad strokes, probably the first patent application you file should probably be a U.S. patent application. It turns out that under U.S. Rules, if you file a U.S. patent application and if 6 months go by during which the U.S. Patent Office does not tell you that you don't have a foreign filing license, then you automatically have a foreign filing license. The mere passage of 6 months without being told that you didn't have a foreign filing license means that you have one. That then legitimizes filing in countries outside of the United States due to the mere fact that 6 months went by without getting bad news. The six-month period is, of course, very helpful. Now, most often these days, the filing receipt will show up before the 6 months has come and gone. When I was first in practice, it was commonplace that you would not necessarily have a filing receipt even after 6 months. But these days, especially given that most people file electronically, the filing license usually shows up long before the six-month period has come and gone. The filing receipt will itself tell you if you have a foreign filing license. Now, as it happens, every case I have ever filed got a foreign filing license. But if you talk to a bunch of different patent practitioners, you will hear that every now and then somebody will file a patent application and they will be told that they do not have a foreign filing license. And this will be the signal that they can't file in foreign countries until they figure out what's going on, until they manage to get a foreign filing license. The chief reason I'm mentioning this in the present lecture is simply that when you receive your filing receipt, it makes sense to look at it and figure out what it says about whether you do or do not have a foreign filing license. And if it says you don't, you need to think about it. If you're in a patent firm, it means you need to take this piece of paper, this filing receipt, and show it to some of your colleagues in the office so that everybody can see it, and it'll remind people that sometimes you don't get a foreign filing license. And then everybody can sit down and try to figure out what to do about this surprising event. And in particular, you're then going to need to make a note on the file to remind yourself that you best not file it in any foreign countries until you make sure you know what your situation is. There is a general topic of docketing that I touched upon very, very briefly earlier, but docketing is important. Docketing means keeping track of dates by which things need to be done. In a typical patent firm, there will be a docketing department or a docketing person. In a corporate patent department, there will very often be a docketing department or a docketing person. The docketing department has the day-to-day responsibility of keeping track of dates by which things need to be done. If you are a docketing person, I will offer you my personal thanks. You are making the world better than it was before you took that job. Docketing is a very important job. If you are a docketing person, you already know how important your job is because you work in an office where docketing is of course important. And the fact that docketing is being done helps to protect the firm against liability for missing a due date. It helps the inventors, the applicants, by minimizing the risk that they would lose their substantive rights. If you're in a corporate patent department, the docketing is important, because the company, the corporation, does not want to lose substantive patent rights. What are examples of docketing activities that we've talked about so far? One example is that we learn from the inventor that the invention was sold or offered for sale on a particular date. Well, so the docketing person will go mark down a 1 year period for this. Make sure the patent application is filed before the 1 year has come and gone. Typically, the docketing will also include a warning. perhaps a 1 month warning, maybe a 2 month warning, that we need to really focus on this. After all, what good would it do if the only thing the docketing person does is come to see you at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and say, a year ago it was sold or offered for sale. Guess we better file our patent application today. Well, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that's not much help because there isn't very much time between then and the end of the day to write a patent application, give it to the inventor, have the inventor review the patent application, make changes as necessary, revise it, put it down for a little while, think about it, see if there's anything else we want to add. And by the way, what if the inventor happens not to be available that day? The inventor's on a cruise ship somewhere. The inventor's on an airplane. The inventor is unreachable for some reason. No, you don't just dock it the last possible day. You dock it a warning. 1 month warning, 2 month warning. Each office, each group of practitioners might have their own routines for what kind of warnings they like to use. But in general, there need to be warnings. Routinely, I will be in a situation where one of the docket people in my office will come to me and say, you know, you've got 1 week left to get this patent application filed. And what immediately goes through my mind is a feeling of annoyance. Why are they interrupting me? Why are they bothering me? I wish they would leave me alone. And then I realize, well, they are doing their job, which includes trying to protect me from looking like a fool. Because what if I allow that 1 week period to go by without preparing the patent application? Second example, the invention was described in a printed publication anywhere in the world. That deserves docketing. Third example, the inventor, the applicant, is in a position where they are unable to rule out the possibility that they might want to get patent coverage outside of the United States. They don't know for sure whether they're going to want to get patent coverage outside of the United States, but what they do know is that they might want patent coverage outside of the United States, that they are unable to say that they would never, ever want patent protection outside of the United States. If that is the circumstance, then what else do we want to docket? Well, we ask the inventor, do you have any plans to divulge your invention to the public? To reveal it to the public. What does the inventor say? Well, I've invented a better mousetrap, and I plan to put them on the market next month. Starting next month, you can go to a store and buy one of my mousetraps. Well, if that's what we hear from the inventor, then for the purposes of protecting patent rights outside of the United States, we need to get the patent application filed chronologically prior to the day that that invention is going to be divulged to the public by being available for purchase in a store. That needs to be docketed, and maybe with a warning. 1 week warning, 2 week warning, 1 month warning perhaps. Having said that, think of the other things you'd want to know from the inventor. Is the inventor planning to get on an airplane and go somewhere to a professional meeting or an industry meeting of some kind, and are they planning to give a speech in which they reveal this invention to everyone at the meeting? If the answer is yes, then that event that is planned for the future needs to be docketed. What's another example? Is the inventor planning, have they written an article, and will it appear in some journal or magazine? If the answer is yes, figure out what that date is going to be, and let's make sure we file our patent application before that publication occurs. Why? Because that publication in many, many, many countries around the world, that publication will destroy any hope of getting patent coverage in that country, unless the patent application is filed chronologically prior to the publication. What are other docketing examples that we have talked about, or at least that we can talk about now? Well, the notice of missing parts. Suppose you filed your patent application. You filed your patent application and you didn't pay all the money. Maybe you didn't pay any of the money. Well, what's going to happen? You're going to get a notice of missing parts. The notice of missing parts is going to say, we didn't get all the money. We think you need to pay some amount of money, and it will say how much money they think you owe. And then it will add on this late fee for handing in the money late, and it will say, here's the money you need to pay. What else will the notice of missing parts say? Well, when you get a credit card bill, what does it say? It says you have to pay the bill by a particular date. Same thing with the notice of missing parts. It will say the money has to be here by a particular date. This means that if you receive a notice of missing parts, one of the things you have to do is look at it carefully to make sure what the date is by which you must respond to the notice of missing parts. If you are a docketing person and somebody has handed you to this notice of missing parts, part of your routine is that you will study it, you will figure out what the date is for a response, and that is what you will docket. With a notice of missing parts from the U.S. Patent Office, the typical response period will be 2 months, counted from the date of mailing. And it will say right there the day that they think they mailed it, and then you add 2 months to it, and that will be the date by which you have to hand in the missing money, or whatever else it is that's missing. Well, the point here is that the docketing is an important step, an extremely important step. In some firms and in some corporations, the people who are responsible for the patent process will set up not one but two distinct docketing systems. In such a firm, in our firm, for example, we have two distinct docketing mechanisms, each run by a separate person. One person does docketing by means of writing things in little books. Each book is for a calendar year, like 2009 or 2010, and you flip through it and it has a page for each day of the year. And the docketing person will flip the book open to the appropriate page and they will write down whatever it is that's being docketed. Like, certain file number has a notice of missing parts, and today is the day by which we must respond to the notice of missing parts. And this all goes into a paper book, a series of paper books, one for each year. And that's a very important part of the day-to-day functioning of the office. And then we have a second person who does all the docketing by putting it into a computer, running particular computer software. So the docketing process includes putting things into the docketing system, entering into the computer the fact that something is going to have to be done by a certain date, or writing into one of the paper docket books that something has to be done by a particular date. Putting things into the docketing system is one part of the process. What is the other part of the process? The other part of the process is getting things back out of the docketing system. A docket person will flip open their book, starting with perhaps today's date, and they may look through the next week's worth of pages to see what are the things that are coming up that are listed in the book. And then they will go talk to their coworkers, the attorneys or patent agents in the office, and they'll say, well, it says here in my book something's got to be done by the day after tomorrow. And the purpose, of course, is to provide a reminder to the patent attorney or the patent agent that that date is coming up and that something's got to be done. Or for the person who's doing docketing on computer, they may have the computer generate a report that's printed out on the printer, and the report might list everything that has to be done in the next week or something. Putting things into the docketing system, taking things back out. Very important processes. The idea of running the two docketing systems in parallel is important because it minimizes the risk that any one person slipping up will lead to missing a date. In the world of engineering, there is the talk of SPF, single points of failure. You like to think about systems where safety is important or where continued and uninterrupted function is important, and you analyze the system to work out where the single points of failure are, the single things where if one fuse blows, the whole system stops working, or if one power supply fails, or if one wire breaks, one solder joint stops working, one cable comes loose from some other piece of equipment, that you like to identify every possible single point of failure, minimize how many of them there are, ideally reduce the number of single points of failure to zero if you can, or if you can't, at least to make sure that you've identified them and worked out what resources you should allocate to try to minimize the failure, using very high quality components, inspecting the components regularly to catch it if the component is on the verge of failure or whatever. The single point of failure concept is extremely important in the world of docketing. What you would like to have if you run two docketing systems in parallel is the idea that this piece of paper, this notice of missing parts, would be put into the hands of two different people, each of whom would independently calculate what they think is the date by which the response must be filed. Each of them independently reading the date, figuring out whether it's a two-month response period. If so, what do I get when I add 2 months to today's date or to the date of last week when it was supposedly mailed? And you don't let those two people talk to each other at all, because one of them might poison the other. One of them might say, oh, I see this thing here, and it's got to be responded to by May 23rd. Yeah, that's right. And they both put May 23rd into their system. No. That's the opposite of what you want. You want the first person working out that they think it's May 23rd and let them write that down on a piece of paper. Now the other person looks at it independently. They work out what date they think it is, and maybe they'll say May 23rd, or maybe they won't. Then the two people compare notes. Then they say, I think it has to be done by this date. And the other one says, well, wait a minute, I got May 24th. Well, why'd you get that? Well, because the 23rd was on a Saturday, and so it didn't have to be done until the following Monday, or, you know, it was a leap year, or 30 days instead of a month. Whatever the reason might be, that one person got a different answer from the answer the other person got, then they can sit and talk about it and figure out why they didn't get the same answer. But the idea that one person would look at the piece of paper and say, I think it needs to be done by a certain day, and then the other person puts that date into their system. That's the opposite of what you want. You want independent calculations, independent assessment. Imagine the case where one of the people, somehow being in a hurry or they're distracted, they somehow get it into their head that you're allowed 3 months to respond to a notice of missing parts, let's say. And they look at the date and they add 3 months to it and they put that into their computer. And meanwhile, the other person knows the right answer, which is that you only are allowed 2 months, let's say. Well, you'd hope to catch this sort of thing rather than letting one person do it and everybody relies upon the calculation made by one person. These docketing steps are important, very, very important. In some firms, people will try to set up systems that will download information in an automatic way from the U.S. Patent Office databases with a goal of independently getting the information that way. But in most patent firms and in most corporate patent departments, it's basically human beings looking at pieces of paper and putting something into a computer or writing something into a book. The related concept that I can mention is that the U.S. Patent Office is a money-making organization. We might think of them as a nonprofit organization, but they think of themselves as a money-making organization. And part of the money-making that the Patent Office does is that if there's a certain amount of time which by law is available for you to carry out some particular task, they will shorten that time. And they'll say, well, you can have the whole period of time that the law allows, but only if you pay extra money. And otherwise, you got to do it earlier than what the law says you have to do if you don't want to have to pay extra money. They call it a shortened statutory response period. There is a schedule of extension fees. The schedule of extension fees is a schedule where if you want to do something a month late, you're allowed to do it as long as you pay an amount of money that's associated with 1 month. If you want to do something 2 months late, as long as you don't mind paying a larger fee, you can hand something in 2 months late. And so on, all the way up to as much as 5 months late, depending on what particular thing it is that we're talking about. If you get a notice of missing parts, you can respond to it 5 months later than what you would think. If you're allowed 2 months, you could add 5 to it and get 7 months, as long as you don't mind paying for a 5 month extension of time. The 5 month extension of time might cost $3,000 or something. It really can add up. It can be a lot of money. But from the Patent Office's point of view, they love that because you have to pay them the money and they get to keep the money. And they didn't really have to do any work to get that money. All they had to do was receive the check and cash it or something. But the idea of the extensions of time is a very important one. Think how the extensions of time affect the job of the people who are doing docketing. Well, it means that they need to find out whether somebody responded to the notice of missing parts. And if they didn't, then the docketing people need to figure out, well, suppose they do it a month from now, when will it be due? Suppose it's 2 months from now. And the docketing people will end up having to watch over the available extensions of time as part of doing their job. Now, suppose you're not a docketing person. Suppose you're a patent attorney or a patent agent working in a corporate patent department or working in a patent firm. Can you simply ignore all this docketing stuff? Of course not. You must reach a point where you personally know what counts as docketing things correctly or docketing them incorrectly. Why? Because you are responsible for the work done by the people who work for you. You're responsible for your docketing people. You're responsible for the paralegals or legal assistants who help get the work done around the office. How can you possibly be responsibly representing your clients unless you know what counts as doing correct or incorrect docketing so that you can monitor the work of your non-lawyer employees? So everyone who is involved in the patent process needs to know about all of these docketing things. We will have much more to say about docketing as we cover various later points in this series of lectures. In our next lecture, we will talk about what is called a request not to publish. It is a peculiar thing that either is or is not included with a patent application when it's filed. And it, oddly enough, determines whether your patent application will be published or whether it won't. Thank you.